The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Welcome, listeners, to the EMS Educast. We're recording this on the final day of November 2011. I'm Greg Fries, one of your co-hosts, welcoming you on behalf of Bill Toon and Rob Terrio. I feel like life happened in a lot of different ways in November, and this could be the first actual, I think we did two episodes, and this might be the only one that I've made it on. I've had a really busy month, a lot of great things, but also we had to cancel an episode, and I apologize to our guest for that again, but we're hoping to get that one rescheduled real soon. I just wanted also to say at the outset, I've got one of these Kindle Fire tablets in my hands, and I'm just loving it. It just came out a couple weeks ago. I'm reading the first book right now in the Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins, and I cannot put the thing down. And I guess there's going to be a movie about it, I just found out today. Rob, have you heard of the Hunger Games trilogy?
I have not.
Oh, wow. It's kind of like post-apocalyptic survival of the fittest North America thing, and I love it so far. Probably because I like the whole Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, all that kind of fantasy, sci-fi, alternative world type thing, so I'm enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, I read things like Keith Wesley's EKG book and Ken Grauer's EKG book. I'm just kind of somewhat disturbed that way.
Yeah, you're just EMS 24/7.
Why don't you read some good authors?
Oh,
well,
oh.
That's
I think we need to get those two gentlemen on for a rebuttal.
Yeah, right. Come up and for Bill. Bill, welcome back to the EMS Educast.
I think it's welcome back, Greg, to the EMS Educast.
And everybody, I'm thrilled that Rob did an episode last week all on his own, and that could become habit for me, just to sit back and let Rob do it all. So, Rob, kudos to you.
I was at Paramedicine 2011, and there was a speaker there by the name of Dave Taylor, who's a director of urgent hospital care at Liverpool John Moore University in Liverpool, England, and his presentation was so utterly shocking to me as the audience. I thought, you know what, I need to get Walter Tavares, another guest, on the show. So we just went up to my room and sat the iPad on the middle of a table and recorded the show. And I thought, how this goes.
Yeah. So you just wow. So what software is on the iPad that allows you to do that?
It's just a voice memo recording app that was free. And the quality is pretty good. I noticed a bit of a high pitch in the episode 122. I'm not sure how to eliminate that, but yeah. Overall the quality is good. And I had to remind these guys to sit closer to the table.
Right.
But other than that, it was great.
Okay. Yeah, you know, the Kindle Fire, no external microphone, no internal microphone for that matter.
Right.
So
well,
that's...
what do you need one for, right?
Well, to record a podcast just like that by your international panel.
You can do what I do, get an inexpensive iPod Nano and a $2.98 microphone and connect that and do some recordings. I record my classes using the Nano now.
Oh, wow.
The Nano now.
Wow. Well,
yeah, I just clipped it to my shirt. It's fantastic. The quality is amazing.
I'm tempted to say Nano, 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 but I'm not sure how many people in our audience would get that reference.
I didn't get it at all.
Phil?
I'm just yanking your chain.
Oh, okay.
Oh, of course I know who that is.
All right. Well, we've got a guest before we wander off into Greg's favorite TV shows of the 1980s. Mick Gunderson, welcome back to the EMS Educast.
Great. Thank you for having me, Greg.
Are you second-guessing your decision to become on the show right now with this adventure we're having?
Not at all. I was a big Mork and Mindy fan.
Oh, good. Good. So I was trying to think if you've ever been on one of our shows where we're dispersed geographically, or if you've always been on when we've been at, like, say, EMS World or EMS Today, like for our live studio recordings.
No, I've done it both ways.
Okay. Well, terrific to have you back. You were most recently on when we were at EMS World Expo, and we'll try to throw a link to that episode in the show notes as well, but just why don't you get us started by introducing yourself, and I know you've got a new primary job since we've last talked, so maybe it's just to bring us up to speed on what you're up to.
Well, I've spent pretty much my whole career working in EMS. I've been in it for about the past 35 years or so now, and a lot of different clinical and administrative roles. For the past 15 years or so, I've been working full-time doing EMS systems consulting on various types of projects, and one of the most recent ones had me in the Kent County EMS system, which is based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, doing some work for them, and one thing led to another, and now I find myself as their full-time executive director for the EMS oversight agency. But the interesting part is I will be still living in Florida and just spending a couple weeks a month up in Michigan and the rest of my time in Florida. So I've got a long commute.
I recommend Michigan from mid-April to, say, mid-October, and then you spend the rest of the year in Florida.
Well, I thought that would be a good 50-50 division of time,
yeah,
too.
Right.
But no, if everyone's going to go along with that that interpretation. But I'll give it a shot. We'll let you know what happens.
So going back and forth. Well, what I guess I'm curious, just I'm sure as a long career as a consultant, that's not the first time an organization has said, oh, why don't you just come work for us? Was there anything... And I guess it's your comfort level talking about it, but what was it this time that made you think, yeah, maybe now is the time to go to work full time for an organization rather than looking for the next consulting job?
Well, I'm still going to do the consulting stuff, okay, but it'll be secondary rather than primary.
Okay.
So I'm not giving all that up. But the thing that really, that I found interesting about this EMS system and this opportunity was, and I'm sure you guys, you've all been exposed to a lot of different EMS systems, so I think you can appreciate this, is you go into a lot of EMS systems and oftentimes the level of acrimony between the different agencies and the players involved is pretty bitter. And it really makes it difficult to try to move the system forward when people aren't, you know, as civil and professional as ideally they should be. And that really gets in the way of trying to make the system better and move forward. And in spite of the disagreements and issues that the system here has, there was just a very refreshing level of civility and professionalism, even over points of disagreement, that I found so refreshing. And it really gave me hope that there was a very interesting opportunity here to make a big difference in the EMS system here. So that was a big factor. Plus, you know, it's for me, it's been almost like for the past 15 years, I'm visiting friends' house and I get to visit their sandbox.
Yeah.
And I get to examine their sandbox and recommend toys to put in their sandbox and ways in which they can use their toys more effectively. But I never really get to play in the sandbox, you know, and spend some time there. And so this is kind of scratching an itch I've had about having a longer term relationship with an EMS system to really kind of see things through instead of coming in and out as a consultant. So I'm really looking forward to that opportunity.
Well,
it's been a long time since I've been in that role.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific, and congratulations. We just wish you the best there. And, I think as somebody that's always lived in the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, I like to think just that we're just such good people that's part of what you're experiencing there. So we're thrilled to have you in this neck of the country for a good chunk of time. I'm sorry.
You guys should come to Canada. We're like the Chip and Dale of EMS. Everyone's polite here.
Chip and Dale.
And collegial.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not thinking of the same Chip and Dales that you are.
Yeah, not the strippers. Oh. The fuzzy little animals.
Oh.
Come on, Greg.
The chipmunks.
Keep it clean, buddy.
I guess. Oh, like at Disney.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I get it. I should say I've made three trips to Las Vegas in the last 6 months, so maybe that's why my mind went that way. I'm sorry. So, speaking of Las Vegas, the EMS World Expo, Mick, you did two presentations there, or maybe you did one, and I'm thinking of another one that you've also done, but the similar theme of do your protocols punish your best paramedics, or does your CE punish your best paramedics? And that's tonight's topic, is digging into that concept. And so why don't you just sort of present to us the premise, and then we'll have a conversation from there about that idea.
Sure. Yeah, those were both presentations I made at this last EMS World Expo. And the premise behind the two talks is that there is a strong tendency that seems to touch EMS systems, throughout North America, let's say, because I observe this almost everywhere I go, where the continuing medical education, the CME programs, as well as the protocols, tend to be focused on issues surrounding the lowest performing paramedic, the lowest common denominator, if you will, such that you need to provide CE, and you want to make sure that everyone is practicing in a safe and acceptable manner. And so if you have any issues in that regard, from a risk management standpoint, it often compels the system and the educators in the system to address those deficiencies where they may exist. And so consequently, you end up spending a lot of your available time and resources addressing those low-performing folks in your system. And after you've met that need, oftentimes you find out that you run out of time and resources, and the better-performing medics, or the best-performing medics in the system, who may have entirely different educational needs than the lowest performing medics, really aren't getting the time and attention they deserve. And I just have a real fundamental problem with that. And so that was the premise for the CE issue, and it's very similar as it relates to protocols. You want to make sure that all of the clinicians in the system are safe and doing appropriate things from a risk management standpoint. And again, if you have any issues in that regard, you end up prioritizing addressing those issues. And by the time you're done, you really don't have the time, energy, resources, etc., to potentially consider other options in the design of your protocols that might be more accommodating for the higher performing folks in your system. And so that was kind of the gist of the issue that I was trying to wrap my arms around and engage the audience in some conversation about the issue and offer what I thought might be some options for how to resolve those dilemmas.
Do you think this is a new phenomenon to EMS that, what I'm getting at is, I guess, is there's sort of been a dumbing down of EMS education over 20 or 30 years. Was there a glory days of where EMS CE was really high level and complex and aimed at the best, or is this always the way it's been?
In my experience, it seems to always have been that way. It was almost as if, and I think it still still has a lot of these same assumptions behind it, is that you need to make sure everyone is meeting the minimum standards, the minimum requirements, and so you go through those minimum competencies, those minimum level knowledge, skills, etc. And that's where you end up spending your time. And again, I think that's driven by a lot of risk management considerations. And frankly, sometimes it's just easier to do it that way because you can kind of recycle a lot of the stuff from the basic initial training curricula that's out there. And it kind of, you know, rubs my fur the wrong way, because I am more of the mind that when you get out of school, it's the beginning of your education, not the end of your education. And that over the course of, you know, a 20, 30, you know, year career in EMS, you know, you should be dealing with things at a much, much higher level than what you did when you first started. But we really don't design our educational systems and our overall EMS systems around those kinds of principles. And for me, I think that's an opportunity for improvement, let's call it.
Mick, what do you think are some of the root causes, other root causes? Is it that providing a higher level of education is time prohibitive, cost prohibitive? Is it that there's a lack of interest in EMTs to push their education further? Are there other root causes?
I think it's primarily an issue of resources. If you're running an agency, there's going to be a tendency to try to contain costs. And so if you're trying to manage the overall budget and you know, there's finite resources, you got to decide how you're going to spend that money. And so if you're trying to invest in your CE program, you want to make sure that everyone has the CE necessary to recertify and be ready to practice. And once that need is met, that box is checked off, and then it's on to the next issue. So there isn't anything that is compelling EMS systems to promote the professional growth of the EMTs and paramedics working in the system beyond those minimum requirements. We really don't have a lot of EMS research to support or detract from the idea that a better educated workforce provides better clinical care or better outcomes. There's a whole set of arguments about whether or not that is time well invested or not, unfortunately. And so as a system administrator, you have the dilemma of, even if you're sensitive to this potential issue, is there a return on investment for advancing the professional growth and development of your higher level performers? So I think there's a number of issues that kind of rub up against it. But in spite of all of those logical arguments, I think there's also an issue where if you have talented, intrinsically motivated individuals, it's kind of like trying to keep a puppy and not let them, you know, mature. And they just, you know, inherently don't want to stay puppies. You know, they want to grow, they want to mature, they want to stretch and expand. And I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing, and that we as system leaders should try to find ways to leverage that to the system's advantage, rather than, you know, looking at it from such a short-sighted perspective as simply meeting the requirements to get our personnel recertified.
And what are your thoughts about how to go about making that happen? How do you go about catering to the high flyers, and by doing so, perhaps motivate the low flyers to try to advance their knowledge and skills?
Well, let me take that in two pieces. The motivation one separately from the mechanics of the delivery of the CE. One of the thoughts that I have about the way to identify the differences between the professionals working in your organization and what their relative CE needs are is a diagnostic exam, which would be different from a certification exam. Think more like something along the lines of an SAT rather than a minimum standards test. A minimum standards test is simply trying to identify whether or not the person taking the tests passes a minimum threshold to be considered adequate for practice or adequate for, you know, performing their designated job responsibilities. In contrast, what I envision as a diagnostic exam is a much larger scale, a longer ruler, if you will, something that could be used to measure their knowledge and skills over time on a broad continuum, such that at the start of their career, they might be, you know, at the 10 centimeter mark. And over time, they'll, you know, get to the 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, 60 centimeter mark, if you will. But you can measure and monitor that performance over time in aggregate across the entire spectrum of the scope of practice for the paramedic, or in individual discipline areas, be it cardiology, trauma, pediatrics, etc. And by taking that diagnostic exam, the idea is that you would be able to generate a CME prescription, if you will, based on their relative strengths and weaknesses. So someone who is a veteran provider has seen a lot of cases and has had a lot of experiential opportunities, if you will, they might have a very different looking CME prescription than someone who is relatively new. An intrinsically motivated person who, you know, reads their journals every month, follows up on their patients to find out their outcomes, and does all of those sorts of things that a good good professional should be doing, is probably going to have a very different CME prescription than the person who looks at their job as, you know, clocking in, clocking out, and really is not particularly motivated or interested in doing anything more than the minimal requirements. And so that's what I'm trying to address with the idea of the diagnostic exam and the CME prescription, is identifying someone's relative strengths and weaknesses and then allowing them to have the latitude to take different types of CME offerings that address the needs identified in the prescription. And something that can potentially tie into this is something that colleges here in the U.S. use. I don't know if they have anything equivalent in Canada or not, but here in the States we have something called a CLEP exam. Do they utilize those in Canadian schools? Where
essentially, I'm not familiar with that test.
Yeah, sorry, you essentially are able to go in and say you've had some calculus in high school. Or some algebra or something, instead of necessarily having to take freshman algebra or calculus or something like that, you have the opportunity to take a test and have those requirements waived.
Right.
So imagine, yeah. So
yeah, we have something
imagine, similar. Okay. So imagine the EMS parallel to that. You go in and you test out that you meet all the minimum requirements, say, in cardiology. So instead of having to take the usual sort of cardiology refresher, if you will, you now can take electives in cardiology. And with your diagnostic exam, maybe they've identified that you have some knowledge gaps in some of the nuances of STEMI mimics or, you know, fascicular blocks or hypertrophy or, you know, whatever it is that the test identifies. And then we point the EMS professional towards some other types of CE opportunities, maybe if the physician or the cardiac clinical nurse specialist level, if you will, where they can get access to those sorts of things and not necessarily constrain them to the CE offerings that are generated by the EMS system necessarily. Attending EMS or attending cardiology grand rounds or something.
As I'm listening to you describe this, I can't help but think about something like CenterLearn, where you would go in and do a self-assessment and then take a self-directed approach towards your CE.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sort of thing can work, but we would need the system to recognize the testing instrument and give them the latitude to be excused from the more pedestrian CME requirements. And if they meet the criteria for testing out of those pedestrian requirements, they have the latitude to do something a little bit more challenging, and that will help encourage their professional growth.
I like that, pedestrian requirements. Is that some sort of status level or?
Well, and that might speak to the motivation, because I think that it speaks to a more primal level amongst, I think, a lot of EMS professionals, probably all of us on this broadcast, you know, we want to do our best and, you know, don't want to be necessarily considered to be merely average in our performance and knowledge. And so if this provides an opportunity for us to differentiate ourselves at a higher level amongst our peers, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And Mick, so that, go ahead.
Do you think people in EMS are willing to take CE on a volunteer basis if it was offered to them?
As an alternative to the idea of having to take ECLS over again for the 17th time, I think yes.
I'm just thinking if there's required CE within the service. If the service was willing to provide workshops that wouldn't be run in such a way that every single person attends, but they would be run sort of scheduled here and there for people who wanted to attend that. Just wonder, would people be motivated to take those? And maybe I can put this out to Bill and Greg as well.
My experience with that is, oftentimes the elective CE opportunities are sparsely attended if they don't contribute towards their recertification requirements. Now, that's not hard and fast. I mean, there's a lot of people who will go to elective CE opportunities even though they've already met their requirements. But unfortunately, I think those folks tend to be more in the minority.
And I wonder how many services would be willing to accept that and do it anyway. I mention that because when I was a base hospital program manager in Peel Region, just outside of Toronto, we started running continuing medical education workshops, and we ran on average about one a month, and they were completely volunteer. And my view on that was, I'll take whoever comes, even if we have an audience of three people, I'm okay with that. And my hope was that people would take these CE courses, they would learn something new, and they would share that with their colleagues, and it would motivate some of the low flyers to get into that. And it really took off for us. We had some low attendance in some of the workshops, and over time people really started to come in because they'd heard about them, and now it's kind of a standard here in the province.
Yeah, it can happen, but it takes some nurturing. I had a similar experience when I was the education and research director down in Pinellas County. We actually started a paramedic fellowship program modeled on the EMS physician fellowship program, offered absolutely no CE credits whatsoever. We're spending, over 10 hours a week doing stuff with journal clubs, directed readings, projects, a number of things. And I was overwhelmed with applicants trying to get in to the program.
And who's the most difficult group to target? Is the EMTs or the EMTPs?
I would say that the paramedics probably, because the EMTs, if they're interested in professional growth, are generally, I think, going to be trying to work up towards the paramedic level. But then once they reach the paramedic level, then what's the next rung on the ladder, so to speak? And this is where there's the potential tie-in with if you have demonstrated levels of clinical knowledge, skills, proficiency, then might that allow you to have more latitude in the protocols, which kind of ties to the other lecture I did on whether or not your protocols punish your best paramedics. And, you know, so if you've done these things and you've demonstrated a better level of performance and knowledge, et cetera, then might that manifest with different thresholds for when you're required to contact online medical control, different thresholds for the types of procedures and medications, et cetera, that might be available to you that might not be available to others in the system is one potential way that that could be recognized in a tangible way.
Yeah, I want to just go back to the question or comment you made, Rob, about, you know, how do you get people to attend or who attends these things? I think one of the considerations would be that if you were to, say, allow people to test out or to say, you know, I've just had enough, and I'm thinking, like, say, topics like bloodborne pathogens or, you know, some things that just happen every year or every other year. You can't give people a full hour of CE because they tested out of bloodborne pathogens in 10 minutes. I would think you'd have more success saying of, here's an hour of CE now that you've got to fill with something. Go out and find something that either fills a box if you've got this prescription, like the diagnostic way to determine what your needs are, or just do a self-assessment and say, what do you want to get better at or learn more of? And fill that on your own. I also, you know, I'm really intrigued, Mick, about this idea of that, you know, you had a program that was successful that didn't award any CE credit. And sometimes I think, that this quest for hours and free food, can dilute both what the sort of the importance of gathering people together is, as well as sort of like, you know, can be borderline insulting for the audience of like, well, they'll come and listen to anything if we offer them free food. And, you know what people would come and listen to is something really good. And they might even pay to bring a lunch with them if it's a really good presentation or topic.
Yeah, bingo. I think that the whole idea of having to incentivize them coming to the elective CE, in some ways, is a poorly masked attempt sometimes by the educator, to not have to, deliver on the goods in terms of content so well. I think if you have good, compelling content and you can effectively market, the fact that this is available, that there will be an audience. It may be a small subset of the system, like Rob was observing, but those are the people that I think are really worth investing a lot of time and energy in, because those people also tend to be the thought leaders amongst their colleagues. And by influencing that group in a positive way, I think can have a significant ripple effect on the rest of the system.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting book, and the name of the author eludes me, but it's called First Break All the Rules, and it's a book on business. And one of the things it suggests, the premise of the book is, it's okay to have favoritism, to show some favoritism towards your top employees, because if you help them out, it motivates the low flyers. And I think the same principles might apply in CE for EMS.
I agree.
Okay, I'm gonna give a different perspective on this. And the first question I would ask is, the way we currently provide education, primary education to paramedics, do we graduate them with the capacity to learn more, to realize that there is value in going beyond what they have? And I think what's missing here, Mick, is we do not clearly understand what motivates the typical EMS provider for continuing education. And I'm going to stick my neck out and say they're only going to do what's required, the majority. I think that those individuals who are your high performers have already figured out how to learn more on their own and have found ways to get recognized for it. So I think it's one, it's the question of what is the base level capacity of the EMS providers, and then what is their motivation? Is it intrinsic or extrinsic? And I would say for the majority of EMS providers, it is whatever the state that they live in requires, and that's all the majority of them care about, and that those who want to know more or become more already know how to do that on their own.
I would agree with that, but I think that it doesn't have to be that way. I think if we framed the education issue in a different way, so that there was a stronger message at the end of the paramedic course that reinforced the notion that you've just scratched the surface. In this course, you've learned the minimum amount of information necessary to begin your career and your professional development, and that you don't even know what you don't know yet. There's a lot more out there, and that the employer can help reinforce that with an expectation that they grow professionally over the course of their career. And if they're not showing evidence of professional growth and development, that seniority alone will not get them promoted or advanced in the organization. So that if these types of activities become recognized and become part of the decision-making matrix of how you decide who advances in the organization and who doesn't advance, then this whole idea of the professional growth and development has some real currency in the system.
You know, you bring up an interesting point, but this is I'm having another discussion with another group of people. What are employers willing to pay? Let's get down to brass tacks here. You're now the executive director. What is the difference that you're willing to pay for the individual who meets the minimum and the person that exceeds? How much are you willing to pay for that difference?
I reject the premise of the question. I think there's a huge body of management literature that shows overwhelmingly that over the long term, pay is not a particularly effective motivator.
And I was going to say, neither are the extrinsic motivators, where requirements are placed. But I can't help but think of this discussion that Dave Taylor gave at this conference I attended on the weekend, where he described the system in England where paramedics have kind of a nursing model where they keep a portfolio and they're required to do a certain amount of CME, but it is self-directed, and they keep this portfolio, and it seems to evolve into a more of an intrinsic motivator, where they seek out the topics that are interest to them, the topics where they're weak in and need some advancement in, and keeping that portfolio, that self-reflection model, seems to be to evolve into a more intrinsic motivator.
Well,
go ahead.
I just want to challenge you. I'm very well aware of the literature that you're talking about. But until the average EMS provider can make enough money to buy a home, raise two children, and allow his wife to stay at home and not work if she chooses to, or the other spouse stays at home to raise the children, until the salary is at that level, money for the typical EMS provider will still be a motivator.
Oh, yeah, I agree. It is a factor, but I don't think is the only factor. But your point is well taken. So that's why I think if there's a connection between this professional growth and development having a real currency in the organization where they work, that contributes to their opportunities for promotion with those corresponding pay increases or other opportunities to earn more, you know, that's of significance. But kind of like we were talking about with the pizza and whatnot, if the primary reason why they're there is just about the money, perhaps too much of a purist standpoint, I'd rather see someone who really wants to do better patient care and provide a better service, is the reason that they're doing it. And it's not just a financial motive, because I'm not quite sure how sustainable that is.
And you know, I agree with you, but I think that gets back to the individual, because when I was back in New York State, I ran an exceptional paramedic program. And the strength of the program was that I was able to take people were able to rise to the occasion to be successful in the program. And yet, I saw at other programs that I didn't think had high standards, individuals graduate out of those programs that were exceptional paramedics. So it made me begin to think that if an individual really wants to be exceptional, no matter what educational program they go into, they'll be exceptional. So it makes me think that it is an individual. And I think that even if you look at the career of EMS providers, the ones that want to become nurses become nurses. The ones that want to become PAs become PAs. The ones that want to become physicians. And I'm not quite sure, again, still, that the way that the primary education system is established here in the United States promotes the capacity that people have to grow to be more than what they are. And as long as we have individuals that are willing to work as a paramedic for minimum wage or do it totally as a volunteer and maintain another career, it's going to be very difficult to change things.
I would agree with that, Bill, but I think one of the things we could do potentially, and this is actually something that I'm interested in exploring here in Kent County, we've got a brand new medical school in town. And one of the things that I've been intrigued by for quite some time, but was never really in a position to act upon it, was the notion of you come into the medical field, say as an EMT, and you progress to become a paramedic, and then, you know, then where do you go from there? And I thought it would be interesting to explore the idea of working with nursing schools, PA schools, medical schools, and business schools in a way that would allow people to stay employed working in EMS, but accommodating and even encouraging people to take advantage of bridge programs, so that maybe at the end of a 20-year EMS career, you are an emergency physician. And between that endpoint, if you wanted to get off the train at the nursing level or the PA level, or go in the management direction and get off at the bachelor's degree level rather than the MBA, etc. But we do this with the support and encouragement of the EMS system design, rather than having to do it in spite of the EMS system design.
I think it's a
sad statement. Which is what those people use.
I think it's a sad statement that we're having a discussion about EMS being a stepping stone into another health discipline, and is a testament to the low education standards in EMS.
I think maybe there's some generational things going on here, but in many, many disciplines, people are changing careers much more frequently than they did the generation, I guess, maybe older than me, which might be Rob and Bill, or say
sure,
my parents, who are older than both of you guys. But this notion that somebody's going to stay in a job for a profession or a job, or if they're even different, for 20 or 30 years is, I think it's kind of romantic about some past that, you know, so what's wrong if somebody's going to switch? I guess it would be nice that they'd stay in healthcare versus, well, I did the paramedic thing and now I'm going to go do the accounting thing or the computer science thing and sort of totally leave behind all that experience and investment their organization made in them.
Well, there are lots of reasons why, you know, people will move on to another career or a branch of the same career. But I think my sense is that in an industry where EMS providers are not paid well and they're not well educated, the motivation to move to another job is because of the lack of pay, is because of the lack of professional recognition and those things. So
but there's other professions that have lots of recognition and lots of pay, and people move in and out of those professions rapidly.
I don't think to the same degree, though. Forgive the academic pun. Because I think, you know, you'll see more paramedics working to retirement in places like Australia and England and Canada than you do in the U.S. by virtue of the fact that the pay is considerably better, that there's, you know, greater professional recognition, and the education standards are quite a bit higher.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a master's thesis in there, Rob.
Sorry?
I said that sounds like a master's thesis to me.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, after listening to the session the weekend, I wonder if we should be moving to degree level paramedics on a global level. But that's a topic for another episode.
Well, I think it's a pretty easy answer to me. It's yes. Back to sort of the premise of the show, though, that if we were designing CE for our top performers, is there something in there, Mick, that says, is the corollary that says you're okay with your average and below average people washing out of the system, leaving for another job or being terminated because you can find somebody else to come in and maybe they'll either be average, but maybe as your top end education gets better, your hiring standards and the organization just gets better, and so then you can fill the spots with better people?
I think that's certainly something that could happen over time.
Yeah.
If you visualize, you know, your employee population as a bell-shaped curve, if you have the trailing end of that curve that has a little bit or is bumping up against the minimum standards level, that's where you're tending to typically focus a lot of your efforts, is making sure that people stay above that line. But over time, if this strategy is successful, ideally, you'll see the whole bell-shaped curve shift away from that minimum threshold where you have this very comfortable space between the minimum standards and where everyone in the system is performing, and the whole idea of having to focus on the minimum standards becomes a non-issue. That's where I hope systems would get to at some point. Now, you could, you know, arguably just keep, you know, raising the bar, so to speak, and move that line right along with the bell-shaped curve. But regardless of what happens, the population is moving forward, and the level of care, education, skill, et cetera, is moving forward along with it, which is a good thing for the system and the community it serves. But to talk to, back to Rob's point earlier, in that progression I was describing, I'm not necessarily saying they leave EMS. If I'm going the MBA route, hopefully I'm staying in EMS, I'm just taking a management track, but I can stay working in the EMS field if I so choose, with that education. If I go to the physician level, I can become an EMS physician and a medical director or a researcher. I don't necessarily have to leave EMS, so long as, I'm finding opportunities and challenge in the field, I may not want to leave.
You know, I'd have to say after 28 years, I'm still finding challenges and I'm still learning things. And I absolutely agree with the premise of your argument, Mick, and agree with this concept that, you know, I believe very strongly that if services aim their continuing education at the lowest common denominator, their staff will never progress, will never truly improve. I think that if you want to increase proficiency at the minimum level, you really have to take EMS providers up a step, up a level. And the key is, how do you do that by intrinsic means, but how do you eventually get to the point with people where they start to look inward and there's some, you know, start to develop some intrinsic motivations? That's the big challenge, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I see it as a cultural issue. It's not a technical challenge. I mean, the content and all that sort of stuff is out there. We can become curators of content and make those sorts of resources available. Just like you have found resources in EKG interpretation, et cetera, to feed your intellectual interests, you know, all of that content could be curated and made available to colleagues that are interested, as you already do. So I don't think the issue is that, you know, there's content out there that we would need to develop. I submit that it's already out there. We have the cultural issue of trying to, you know, look at this as a career-long professional growth expectation that we put out in the system. Right now, I think the expectation is that you maintain minimum standards, and we as system leaders, you know, don't create higher expectations. It's a lot like the whole issue of a teacher. If they don't expect more of their students, they won't perform more. But if you expect more, oftentimes they'll rise to the challenge. And I think that's where we as an industry have a weakness and an opportunity, is I think we should start thinking a little bit more creatively about how we could craft our systems and our cultures to expect and help facilitate going to a higher level.
We could probably learn a great deal from the athletic industry, you know, because a basketball game, the rules don't change, but the players are motivated to work harder, learn more, you know, learn the science of basketball and become better players via a whole bunch of different means, and that's something we really lack, I think, in EMS.
Guys, we're reaching the
point. Yeah,
let's see. Go ahead, Mick. I was just going to say we're close to the point we're going to have to wrap this up, so maybe respond to Rob there, and then we'll move into the closing portion.
Yeah, Rob, your comment, I think, is great. It makes me wonder, what's the EMS equivalent of Kobe Bryant going, you know, to the court a couple hours before the game and just throwing free throws over and over and over again and, you know, honing his skills, you know, to the nth degree? What's the EMS equivalent of that?
Compressions on the sofa. I don't know. That's a good question. Listening to podcasts like the EMS Educast.
We have a different, you know, Mick, you bring up an excellent point. We do need to wrap it up, but I think that EMS does not, the majority of EMS does not perform at the Olympic level.
And we don't even have the score tools in place to know if we're performing at the Olympic level. We don't have scorecards that even accommodate a lot of this stuff.
Right. Kobe Bryant's got a box score at the end of every game and, you know, and film study. You know, so we're close to the point where we've got to wrap this up. And, Bill, when you jump back in, try to get your audio back up. You were really low there. Maybe each of us will just go around with either a final thought or a question for Mick, and then Mick, you can wrap us up as well. I just wanted to add as my final thought here is that I Googled how often do Americans change their careers because of this often cited thing that we'll have seven career changes, and I'll add a link to a Wall Street Journal article about how there's no origin on that, so it's a bit of a myth. And then there's an interesting graphic that shows between 96 and 2008 the duration that somebody's been on the job. So while career changes seem to be more frequent early in the career, you know, in 96, 99% of people reported being with the same employer for 20 years or more. And in 2008, 10.3% of people reported being with the same employer for 20 years or more. So, you know, that I guess I'll include in the show notes for people to check out more. Rob, do you have a closing thought or comment?
I think I've just about exhausted all my all my best material, but my personal belief is that education is the key to loving your job and longevity in this EMS career. And the question is how I think some of us who love it with this level of passion have to look back and think, deconstruct sort of our whole process, and how did we come to this point? How did we come to love it so much that we want to continue to learn? And how do we foster that in people starting their careers in EMS? That's the challenge.
Thanks, Rob. How about you, Bill?
Oh, I agree. I think that education is the answer. And I think that the way that we're going to develop the capacity to be lifelong learners is by having a solid educational system that I do not think exists here. I think that we're beginning to develop the rudimentary findings by expecting accreditation of all paramedic programs in the future if you plan to sit for the National Registry exam. But we're just at the infancy of that. And but I do agree, education is the way, and I applaud Canada for having the high standards that it does, and it sounds like Australia does, and I still think in England it's a mixed bag, but I think they're ahead of the United States when it comes to the education of pre-hospital care providers.
Thank you, Bill. And Mick, closing thought or comment or question you have for us?
Yeah, what I'd like listeners to kind of come away with is just the notion of how could we take those intrinsically motivated, intellectually curious folks that work in our respective systems and help foster their professional development in a way that they can grow with the support of the system rather than in spite of the system, which is the current state of affairs I generally observe. How can we help those people rather than getting in their way and begin at that point?
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Mick. If listeners want to connect with you, how can they get a hold of you?
The best way is at my email address, mick.gunderson, G-U-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, @gmail.com.
Excellent. Well, we sure appreciate you being back on the EMS Educast. We'll have in the show notes links to some of the books and articles and things that we talked about tonight, so you can always find show notes, listeners, for episodes at emseducast.com, because many of you listen through iTunes or Stitcher or the ProMed Network or many other ways that you might be able to find links to our shows. We always appreciate your comments and questions and show suggestions at facebook.com/emseducast. And in just a couple weeks, I'm looking forward to visiting and meeting Bill for the first time in person. I'm going to Kansas City. So Bill, I'm looking forward to it. Do you have a lot of great things planned?
Oh, you're going to be very busy.
Oh, good. Good. That sounds ominous. So maybe if we have any listeners in the Kansas City area, Bill, maybe we should find out a way to try to connect with people.
Absolutely. We can try to do a meetup so they can meet you.
All right. And Bill. So facebook.com/emseducast might be the place to look for those ideas. Until next time, Make sure you go back to the archives, listen to old shows, tell your friends and your colleagues about the EMS Educast. We appreciate your support. On behalf of Bill Toon and Rob Theriault, this is Greg Freese for the EMS Educast.